Look out, Boxwoods. A very hungry caterpillar is back in town. The box tree moth and its babies are here with a vengeance. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our gardening show, we'll get the latest on these invasive pests, how to spot them, and what to do about them. We'll also discuss the idea of succession planning for trees and break down what to do in our gardens to prepare for cooler weather, which we are told will be here eventually. Joining me now are Madison Tree Care and Landscaping CEO John Butcher, University of Cincinnati Professor Teresa Cully, and Brick Gardens owner Dominique Peebles. Welcome back, everybody. It's great to have you here.
Hi, Lucy. Great to be here.
Hey.
They are ready to answer your questions, and we know you have questions. Call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Teresa, this feels a little bit like Back to the Future because we talked about box tree moth and boxwood problems over and over and over again a couple years ago. But are they particularly bad this season? What's going on with these little guys?
Yeah, they're actually quite bad right now. And especially we've been hearing a lot of reports about the east side of town. And so what we can say, what's interesting for me as a scientist, is we've seen a sudden uptick in damage. And just the average person seeing something strange happening to their boxwoods probably within the last month or so.
And are there particular cultivars that hold up better than others when it comes to boxwoods?
That's a great question. That's something that we're studying right now. We have a whole plot, and we're testing 22 different cultivars right now in northern Cincinnati area. Some of those cultivars are available in the stores nowadays, and other ones are currently under development. So the quick answer to your question is that we are, yes, seeing that some cultivars to appear to be resistant to those caterpillars, while other cultivars are just being decimated and killed off within a few weeks, if not less than that.
Now, I know you and Joe Boggs, our friend from Ohio State, who's on the show often, have a free seminar about this today from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. Is it too late to register for that?
No, you can go ahead and register.
Okay.
You could do it different ways. You could go just search Joe Boggs.
Joe Boggs Boxwoods.
That will do it. The seminar is through the OGIA, the Ohio Green Industry Association. You can also get to it, I believe, through the Ohio Department of Agricultural website as well.
Okay, and we have a link on our website, wvxu.org, so folks can look there. John, are you getting lots of calls about boxwoods this season? And I'm thinking you're going to say yes.
Oh, yeah. No, it's last year we saw it in Loveland a little bit and maybe parts of Montgomery. This year it's Indian Hill, Milford, Montgomery, everything next to that. Starting to creep into Anderson a little bit. And I feel like next year, the way it spread this year, it's going to be throughout the whole city.
So how do you recommend people deal with box tree moth?
So right now, the best method that we have is to do a topical insecticide treatment. I was really hoping that we'd have something systemic that we could put into the soil and have as a preventative that's kind of waiting in the wind. And when the bug lays the eggs there, that kills the bugs when they try it. But there's nothing that really has a long efficacy that makes sense for that yet. I'm hoping that our brilliant scientists come up with something that helps with that. But the other strategy is really to evaluate your landscape and say, hey, do I need 300 boxwoods? And the people that have a lot and are heavily invested in this landscape boxwood scenario are probably going to treat for a while. People that just have a few boxwoods, I think you just find a different plant to put in there and switch them out. And really, if you're buying new plants, we should be looking at different kinds of plants than just boxwoods, which we've always talked about on the show.
Yeah. Yeah. More because boxwoods aren't really not natives, right?
I do not know of any native. There may be one.
This is interesting. There's actually no native species. The boxwoods that we have in our garden, there's actually three different species. Two are actually more from Asia, and one is from a European, the English boxwood.
So, Teresa, how do you spot the box tree moth caterpillars?
Oh, so oftentimes you might have a boxwood plant. Maybe it's at the foundation of your house, and you might look at it and it looks strange. You might see some leaf curling. You might see it starting to change color a little bit. And you got to be a little careful because sometimes with cold winters, you get some of that damage too. But if you look closely, you're going to see some webbing. It almost looks like a spider. It's silk, actually, from the caterpillars. Once they get going and start eating, they have frass, which is a fancy name for poop. And you could see that littering in, and then they start munching on the leaves. And you see a very characteristic, Joe Boggs calls it the curlicue, where it's actually the leaf and they're eating the inner part and it leaves like an outer U. And by the time the plant is at that point, it's pretty severely infested typically.
It's like people who don't like the edges of the brownies. They just eat the middle.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, we have a question already from Shannon. She emailed, can you provide guidance on propagating a dogwood from branch cuttings? I feel like that goes to you, John.
Well, I'm not an expert propagator in dogwoods. From branch cuttings, it may be possible to do rooted cuttings. And I don't know if we're talking about like a Cornus florida, which is like the native dogwood tree that I assume they're referring to, because certainly some of the shrubs like yellow twig and red twig dogwoods, you can take dormant season cuttings of those in the winter, plug them into some soil media and have a little bottom heat and they'll grow right away. I think a lot of dogwoods trees are grafted when they're propagated that way, and that's a much more intensive process where they'd have to grow a seedling dogwood out, then cut a bud out of the dogwood they want to grow, and then slip that bud into the stem of the seedling, and then you rubber band it. I would like recommend YouTubing some videos or something. It's pretty hard to describe all of that on the air, but it's not going to be a really easy thing. I would actually recommend, if it's the native dogwood, to try to use the fruit.
Oh, sounds like a lot of science there. Teresa, you have anything to add to that?
No, I think what he said is entirely correct. I would go for the fruit.
Okay.
And there's probably a dormancy requirement for that, which means it needs to be put in the cold for a little bit. And I don't know what that is, but it's readily available online to find the dormancy requirement for a native dogwood. And you put it in the fridge for a little bit at whatever temperature. And then when you put it in the pot after that, it should start to sprout.
Okay. We're talking about gardening for the full hour today. We have experts here to answer your questions. Call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We got an email from Tisa with a number of questions. She is moving in October, and she wants to move about 75% of her garden. She's wondering if she can plant what she moves in the front yard area. It looks like the area was tilled. She plans to fill it and add compost to it, as well as garden box soil. She wants to know, will her pollinator plants survive in winter pots, or should she put them in the garage if she can't get them all planted? She just bought 11 flowering trees for a steal. She'll be using them as kind of a front yard providence. She wants to know when it's okay to get them in the ground. Took her years to get her common milkweed growing. Should she save the seeds and share them? Can she transplant the common milkweeds? She's got two other varieties of milkweed she's taking. She's got two types of this orange bug/beetle that likes to cover them. She wants to know what those are and how to get rid of them. I'm going to start there with those questions and toss those to you, Teresa, because then we have some bush and tree questions that I'm going to hit John up for.
Okay, sounds great. So first of all, my advice is to make sure that the new owner of your house is okay with this plan. That's important. And if they are, in terms of the milkweed, let's tackle that one. If you have common milkweed, it is very easy to just cut, just dig up one stem even and transplant it. That thing transplants very easily. That's not a problem at all. If you have other species of milkweeds, so for example, swamp milkweed is something that the monarch caterpillars really love. I've actually had success just digging it up from one place to another in my yard. I do think with that, you could dig it up temporarily and put it into a pot. And I would, of course, I think the idea of a garden or of a garage is a really good one.
Mm-hmm. And what about these pollinator plants? Can they survive in winter pots?
You could try it. I think they probably could. You might also be able to put it in a pot and put it near the base of the house. That might help. So something that's warm, that's not going to freeze too much. I think that might work. You can also, of course, buy a new one if you want to. But yeah, I would try it.
Well, before we get to the beetles, I realize there is a flowering tree question in here. 11 flowering trees. She's going to be using them in the new front yard, I guess. When is a good time to get those in the ground, John?
Well, getting them in the ground isn't as critical as when you dig them. And so digging them, you want to do in the dormant season. Fall is best for most once the leaves start to fall off. Early spring is fine before the new leaves start to come out, depending on what species. Some, like oaks and beech trees and a few other trees, prefer to be dug in the spring, but most are fall, and she didn't specify, and she's saying flowering trees, which aren't oaks and beech trees, but I would dig them up this fall, either put them in a pot or ball and burlap them so that everything's held together, and then how she stores them for the move or whenever the move is might be the critical part, and she may want to put them into like some wood chips or into gravel or into insulate them with a bunch of straw to get through the winter, because that can be the challenging part depending on when she's going to move.
Okay. And what about these orange bug beetles that like to cover the milkweed? Are those a problem?
Actually, no, they're not a problem. It's a natural pest. I leave them alone, actually, on my milkweeds. I think it's going to be more trouble than what it's worth to try to remove them because it is nature. They're just a normal part of the whole milkweed ecosystem, if you will.
Okay, they just coexist. Well, Tisa's got more questions, but before we ask those, I want to get you in this conversation, Dominique. What are you doing at Brick Gardens to prepare for the fall?
So it's harvest season. So we're heavy into that right now. So, you know, every day something else needs to be harvested, and also monitoring like what plants are nearing the end of their season. So starting to prep those areas for transferring some fall type crops. But this is the time of year where we really focus on harvest and planning for either the fall, winter, or even the spring. So right now at Brick Gardens, I mean, we're like really concentrating on like what things we're going to do for the fall and the winter. So right now we're cleaning up, removing most of this, you know, whatever plants we had over the summer, getting rid of weeds and debris, but still trying to be mindful of pollinators that are still out there eating. So even during cleanup, there's some things that we're just leaving for, you know, our friendly pollinators. So we'll leave some flower heads or seed heads and stuff like that. And then even when we look at our herbs, like our basil and stuff like that, this is the time of year we really start to let it flower so that we can keep those pollinators fed. But then the other stuff we're starting to do is areas of the farms that we know we're not going to be using in the fall and winter, we're starting to do stuff like soil testing, using whatever methods you have of tilling your soil to aerate it and let it, you know, rest and get ready for new planting and stuff like that. So yeah, this is the time of the year we kind of look forward to because it says things are slowing down for us, but at the same time, it's the busiest time of year. And we're just making sure that everything we do sets us up for success for the next season.
Well, that does sound busy. We have a caller on the line. Hey, Jeannie, thanks so much for calling. What's your question? Can you hear me, Jeannie? Hi there.
Yeah. Hi. I have, a lilac kind of bush, a larger shrub, and it has lost all of its leaves. And now the leaves are growing back, and I'm not sure what's happened or if there's anything I need to do.
Oh, good question. What do you think, John?
Most likely there's some kind of foliar fungus at play that makes sense this year because we had so much rain and wet and humidity through the summer, and you get some kind of foliar fungus that causes the leaves to fall off. The stems and buds are still good, mm-hmm. and we're actually not out of the growing season all the way yet, and so we're in a period where the fungus is not so likely to take hold now because the weather's a little bit nicer and new leaves are sprouting out. So I think everything's probably fine.
Okay, Jeannie, I hope that helps.
It does. Thank you.
Sure thing. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. Okay. Dominique, let me ask you some more about what you're doing at Brick Gardens. What are some of those fall crops you're planning to plant or you're preparing to plant?
Good question. So this is a, you know, we start looking at cold hardy plants at this point. So we're starting to prep beds for carrots or turnips, radishes, things like that, that, or especially the radishes, they have kind of a quicker turnaround time. Then we start doing leafy greens and things like that, that we've transferred over to some of the beds that we've, you know, completed the summer session on, things like that. So again, carrots, root vegetables, different types of leafy greens, stuff like that is what we are preparing for. Also, this is the time of year to start sourcing or planning what type of garlic you're going to plant, because next month is typically when we start putting that stuff in the ground, because that likes to grow a little bit before it gets really cold. And then, you know, next spring, you start seeing that beautiful smelly garlic start popping up. So those are the things that we get excited about planting now. So that's what we're up to. And also understanding that most of our brick garden locations, they're different. They're multiple locations. So each location is going to require us to do different things based on what grows best in those areas.
That makes sense. Well, we got another email. This one's from Joanne. Joanne writes, a beautiful old oak in my backyard gets tubacchia, leaf spot, some years worse than others. This year has been particularly bad with leaves beginning to drop in early August. I know this is mostly a cosmetic problem, but is there anything I can do, and have your guests noticed this in other trees?
Certainly tubacchia is something that's been around for a while. It's a foliar fungus. It is mostly just aesthetic. There are systemic fungicide treatments that can be applied to help minimize that and actually get rid of it over time. Usually it takes several years of treatment to do when you treat early in the spring and then come back the next year and do it again. And after a few years of treatment, we've had pretty good luck cleaning up the other trees we've seen with that problem.
Okay.
And the other thing is, I don't know how the diagnosis came about, but you really would need a lab analysis to say 100% it's tubacchia.
Are there lots of trees that get affected by this, or is it mostly oak?
As far as I know, it's just oak trees that get that, but there may be something else that I'm not aware of.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back with our gardening show after that. And if you've got questions, now's a good time to call. The number is 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. Are you thinking ahead to November's election? Join me in our new building at 8 p.m. September 24th for a live politics show. Get more information and register to attend right now at wvxu.org. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with today's gardening show, and we have experts ready to answer your questions. My guests are University of Cincinnati Professor Teresa Cully, Brick Gardens owner Dominique Peebles, and Madison Tree Care and Landscaping CEO John Butcher. The number to call is 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We have more questions from Tisa, who had emailed us after the last gardening show. She is the listener who is moving a bunch of her garden or is hoping to move it to a new location. She has four blueberry bushes, chokeberry, and she'll be taking her volunteer elderberry and mulberry trees, raspberry and blackberry plants. Can these be dug up and sheltered in the garage? Dominique, do you have experience with raspberry and blackberry plants? Do you have advice on those?
I do have experience with that because we have those at each one of our locations. However, we've never dug them up and moved them anywhere. So that's something that I would refer to the other people to give their expertise, because we've never had to dig them up and move them where they're at. Is just where they stay. So I'm even interested to hear any tips on that in case we end up having to switch some, because I'd hate to leave them behind.
Sure. Teresa, you have thoughts on those?
Yeah, I actually have a blackberry bush that I really like. And what I've noticed is that it can sprout from the base sometimes. And you might be able to move those. However, you have to be careful because some of those blackberry bushes are indeed grafted, sort of what John was talking about earlier for some trees. And so if you're grabbing something from the base, it might actually not be the plant that you purchase. So for example, I have a thornless blackberry. I do not like thorns. And so you'd want to double check and make sure you're actually planting and transplanting the thing that you really want.
Okay. What about these trees, John, that Tisa's asking about, the volunteer elderberry and mulberry trees? Do you have thoughts on those? Can they be dug up and sheltered in the garage?
There's no reason that they can't be dug up. I'm a little concerned about the sheltered in the garage just because I don't know what the temperature is in the garage. And if it's a heated garage, it's probably going to confuse the plant a little bit. You'd be better off to dig them and insulate them in, once again, wood chips, a bunch of straw, something where they're attached to the ground and almost buried in something and not just sitting above catching the air and cool breeze.
So can she replant them right away in the new location?
So the best case scenario would be that she would dig them up and plant them right away. If that's not an option now, let's assume that she's moving at some point over the winter. Her best bet's probably to dig them at some point this fall, store them under wood chips or whatever she's going to use to store. But if she's not moving until March or April, I think she could wait until March to pop this stuff and take it straight over and put it in the new place.
Okay. Again, we're talking about gardening for the entire program today. Our experts are ready and they're waiting to answer your questions. Call 513-419-7100 or you can email talk@wvxu.org. One more question from Tisa. What about Rose of Sharon? She says, can my Rose of Sharon be dug up and moved? I've had her 6 years. I'm not sure how much damage could happen. Do you have thoughts on that, Teresa?
Yeah, let me take that one. So if it's a six-year-old Rose of Sharon, it's probably rather large. At least mine used to get pretty big. That might be too large to actually transplant effectively. I don't know. John might have a different idea.
Depends on how much energy you want to put into it.
That's true, too. What I would recommend, though, is I've noticed Rose of Sharon, sometimes it seeds around the yard, so there might be some babies popping up. So I think it might be a better idea to maybe dig up one of those and move that one over.
Okay.
I think that's a great idea. One other thing that could be happening, though, is there are some sterile varieties that don't produce seeds. And if that's what she's lucky enough to have, you're going to have a hard time finding the seedlings around.
That's a good point. And okay. I'd also add really quickly, if it's spreading by seeds, you might want to be careful because that thing might become messy and all around your yard, and it might eventually become an invasive. So you got to be careful.
Yep.
Okay. We got an email from Ken. Ken writes, I have a volunteer Japanese maple about chest high. Trunk is about a half inch thick. How and when would you transplant this to another location? Sounds like one for you, John.
Yeah. Well, I think right now is a little early, but once we start seeing the leaves drop off this fall, I think it'll be a great time. If the soil still happens to be really dry then, you may want to wait until we start getting a little rain. You may water it in if that time hits. But if we're typically end of October, early November is a really good time. And digging a really nice root ball that encompasses as many of the roots as you can get. There's nursery standards online you can look up that say for X amount of size of a trunk, you need this size of a root ball. Typically, it's about 12 inches of root ball per inch of trunk. And try to dig a really nice compact ball that's not falling apart and get it out and get it right back in. Best thing you can do.
Okay. John, we promised our listeners that we would talk about succession planning or planting when it comes to trees. We've talked about that with crops and vegetables and all that good stuff. Is this a good time to think about that, the planning or the planting of young trees, if you're worried about older trees that might have numbered days in your landscape?
I think it's always a good time to think about that. And I know I'm a little biased because I take care of trees, but when you look around at a lot of landscapes, there's a bunch of 7,500-year-old trees and maybe three or four trees in the yard are around the same age, and there's nothing younger to take over the spot. And what I like to think about is having something started sooner than later. That way, when one of these older trees goes, there's a new tree that's not starting over as a tiny little sapling, and you actually have something significant. This is pretty tough in some smaller landscapes, but in the bigger yards and estates and big properties should absolutely be part of what they're thinking about. Golf courses, a lot of those places.
How much space do you have to give those bigger trees, though? You don't want to plant a baby right next to an old tree and interfere with its root system or anything, right?
Depends on how bad the condition of that old tree is. If you think you've just got a couple of years left, I do think that squeezing something in a few feet away is a reasonable thing. If you think it's got another 20 or 30 years, you may want to give it a little more space or wait to make that decision. But if it's on the way out and it's got a bunch of decay and your arborist is telling you this is a limited situation, I think planting sooner than later makes tons of sense.
Okay. Well, could the grandma or grandpa tree kind of help the baby with its, organic material underground?
Maybe there's some help there. And I know there's lots of things about trees talking to each other and connectivity. But I think that introducing a new level of competition into an unestablished ecosystem, they're probably not talking as much as they would be in like a forest scenario.
Okay, that makes sense. Teresa?
I just add, you also have to think about what type of tree you have. So for example, if you have a black walnut, it produces juglone, these compounds that prevent other plants from growing right underneath it. It's actually a really smart idea for a tree.
Yeah.
So if you have a seedling and you plant it right within, next to an older black walnut, the seedling might not do well, or the sapling. So you have to think about that. In other words, you just need to know your trees.
Yeah. Makes sense to me. Well, we've got gardening experts here to answer your questions. Call 513-419-7100. You can always email talk@wvxu.org. We have a question from our fabulous technical director, Carlos. It's pawpaw season. I found dozens of mature fruits in the woods by my house. I heard there are different laws about foraging in Cincinnati parks versus Ohio parks. Do you have any knowledge about that, Dominique? Do you? He said he doesn't ask. Don't ask Carlos how he knows, but they were delicious. So he's not guilty of stealing anything, but they're tasty pawpaws, according to a source we will not name. So, Dominique, do you have any thoughts about pawpaws?
I don't have a lot of experience with trees. I do love pawpaws. But I'm very ignorant to the laws and stuff about them. So usually when I find them on the ground, that means they're able for me to harvest. So that's typically the sign that I use. So I would love to hear if I'm within the guidelines or outside of them.
Yeah. Go ahead, Teresa.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you find the fruits in the forest, you're actually really lucky, because usually those are nabbed right away by the local wildlife. I do know that the Cincinnati Nature Center is having a foraging fest coming up. So it's specifically for people who went to forage on their property. So that's an idea. You might want to look for foraging opportunities. It's becoming a lot more popular nowadays, and so there might be a lot more opportunities for that.
Okay, that's great. We have Charlie on the line. Hi, Charlie. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks for calling. What's your question?
This is going to be different. I have knockout roses that just do not do well in my yard. There's too much shade. I'd like to take them to our cottage in Michigan that's 500 miles north of here. So question one, will they work? It's at the 45th parallel. Two, how would I transport it if you think it would work? In other words, would they survive the transportation? And if they would, could you give me some hints on how to do it?
Mm.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's an interesting one. What do you think, John?
Well, one of the questions Teresa and I were looking at each other, she said, how big are they, which could affect, but let's just assume it's an average size rose that's a couple feet tall, nothing crazy. You should be able to pop those out with a shovel, slide them into a container, and head north. I am not completely familiar with what hardiness zone you're talking about moving them to, but I would imagine that if you were in zone 5, you'd be completely good with roses. Zone 4 is like north of northern Ohio. I don't know where it actually cuts off, but middle of Ohio and even through most of Ohio, I'm certain you can grow knockout roses. If you get up into the UP or upper Michigan, it might be a little too cold to overwinter. But one thing about knockout roses that's different than other roses is they're not grafted. So if they die back to the ground and they sprout back out, you still have a knockout rose that's coming back up.
Anything you want to add, Teresa?
No, that sounds good. I've actually never tried that. I've dug up fairy roses and move them successfully, but not a knockout.
They're pretty easy to move.
Okay. Well, Charlie, if you do it, call us back and let us know how it goes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Okay. Well, we will be back after a short break to wrap up our gardening show. We have not heard from you. We're expecting to hear from you. And if you have questions, call right now. The number is 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back to wrap up today's gardening show. My guests are Brick Gardens owner Dominique Peebles, Madison Tree Care and Landscaping CEO John Butcher, and University of Cincinnati professor Teresa Cully. If you've got questions, don't delay any longer. Call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. You know, Dominique, earlier we were talking about all the different things you're doing at Brick Gardens, and you've got a lot that you're juggling, but you mentioned leaving stuff behind for wildlife. Can you tell us a little bit more about your strategy for that? And then I want to get Teresa's thoughts on that too.
Yeah. So, I mean, people that grow fruits and vegetables, we obviously depend heavily on our pollinators to help us pollinate. So, you know, we're really heavily focused on putting certain types of flowers and native plants and herbs and things like that out in the summer. But that's also a huge food source for bees and birds and things like that. So this time of year, rather than just go through and start cleaning everything out, we tend to leave a lot of the things we know the bees and birds and things like that will still feed on. So sometimes we just plant certain type of late flowering plants, like native late blooming flowers that basically provide the type of nectar and pollen that the pollinators like. Leave seed heads of plants like coneflowers, sunflowers, and stuff like that. So even when, you know, our sunflowers start to look weak, we'll just take the heads off of them and leave them in the garden or put them on the picnic tables and things like that. Another thing that people don't think about is providing water sources, stuff like that. I mean, they still get thirsty. So we set out shallow dishes of water with pebbles and stuff like that for landing spots to help, you know, quench that thirst and things like that. And then always, as a practice, we avoid all pesticides because that's the stuff that can really affect them and things like that. So, you know, it just be mindful that the things that help you throughout the summer may need a little of assistance in the fall and winter. So that's a practice that we always put in play.
Yeah. Teresa, you were talking about pesticides during the break, and that is an issue even with our boxwood discussion we had earlier, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, with the boxwoods, when you apply pesticides, what you really want to do is you want to do it if you see an infestation going on. And so there's excellent fact sheets available from Joe Boggs on the website for the Ohio State Extension. But the point he makes, which I think is excellent, is that you don't want to just preemptively start spraying your boxwood plants because that can actually do more damage than good. It can kill off some of the beneficial mites, for example, that normally keep the boxwood caterpillars in check. So you got to be careful with that.
Well, we have lots of calls now from our listeners. Hey, John, thanks so much for calling. What's your question?
Yes, I have a deck. I'd like to plant arborvitaes about 5 feet tall, purchased from a nursery, in canisters. And if I put them in large pots with good compost and soil and drainage, will they survive a Cincinnati winter outside on the deck?
Yeah, certainly they can. The bigger the pot, the better. That's more insulation for the winter. You can also do things like insulate your pot. Isn't a bad idea. I've seen people use bubble wrap on the inside of the pot, but you don't want to insulate the bottom because you need it to drain still. But
correct.
Really go on the big side, not skimp.
Okay. Do you want to add
these
something?
These are not, they're not balled up. They're in canisters. I think they're two gallons. So I need a 5 gallon pot. Does that sound right?
Well, so what's funny is that with nursery grading of pots, a 5 gallon pot is actually a really small pot that doesn't look like a 5 gallon bucket at all. But mm-hmm. if I was looking to overwinter and have it be like a long-term thing, not just one winter, but consecutive years of growing these arborvitae for a screen, I would be looking at something that's like in nursery standards, like a 25-gallon pot or 30-gallon pot. But in terms of like regular size, think of something that's probably minimum of 24-inch diameter wide, if not bigger.
Okay.
Hope that helps, John.
That's a good marker.
Yeah. Best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for calling. Thank you. We have Robin on the line. Hi, Robin. What's your question?
There. I have four iceberg roses that I planted in the spring in full sun, and they've done a great job this entire summer. The two recently developed black spot, and they're losing leaves from the bottom up. How do I deal with that this late in the season and try to overwinter them for success next spring and summer?
You have thoughts on that, Teresa?
I'm looking over at John a little bit. I mean, my experience, what I do is with the black spot is I just let the leaves fall off, and usually they're better the next spring.
I think this late in the year, the best thing you could do is just clean up the fallen leaves at some regular interval so that they're not laying there and producing more spores. And then I don't know this iceberg rose, but like roses are inevitably going to have lots of plant health care problems. And usually some intervention with treatments is necessary if you're really particular about keeping them clean. And next spring would probably be the best time if you wanted to start doing a fungicide to control that.
Thanks for calling, Robin. I sure hope that helps.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. We have Marissa on the line. Hey, Marissa. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi. I was calling because this year I purchased a lot of little plants. Like I have lavender and I still have pansies that are alive. Should I dig those up and I'm going to bring them into the garage and build like a green room? And will they live throughout the winter next year to plant in the ground? And then I have one other quick question I just thought of. I have an eggplant. Is that thing done or can I bring that in as well?
Let's ask Dom about the eggplant. What do you think, Dominique?
So as a practice, once the eggplant stops producing, we just clear that spot and use it for something else. I've never tried to grow an eggplant inside, and you're better off just getting a new pack of seeds starting those plants in the next season.
Okay.
Because the kind of care you're going to have to try to put into that thing to keep it alive and, inside, you're just going to spend way more effort and time.
Yeah, I'll just add for the pansies or the violets.
The lavender.
Yeah. So the pansies, I would do the same thing. I wouldn't really worry about it. Maybe get another next year. That's like an annual. For the lavender, I've tried it to save it. You can dig it up and put it, in a garage. But honestly, you're going to probably maybe have a 50-50 chance of it surviving.
Okay. Well, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marissa. We appreciate your calling. We have Chaz on the line. Hi, Chaz.
Hello.
What's your question?
My question is, I have access to a pear tree in northern Ohio, and I want to know if it's possible to take a cutting from that and transplant it and then bring it down here and have it grow roots without attaching it to grafting it onto rootstock.
Huh. What do you all think?
It's not impossible to get something like this to produce roots, but at pretty low rate and difficult to do, and I think that grafting it would be the most reliable method for a pear tree. And I hope that it's an edible pear and not a calorie pear.
Oh yeah, this isn't a calorie pear, is it, Chaz?
No, it's a delicious pear. I think it's
okay.
Feral.
Okay. Okay. You have anything you want to add, Teresa?
No, I was going to ask the same thing. Yeah. But I agree with John. And you can make it work, but the grafting approach is much better.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hope that helps. Thank you. And we have Joe. Hi, Joe. Thanks for your patience. What's your question?
Yeah, thank you. Hey, I've been looking for a native plant that's was common in the Midwest. It's called a hop tree, H-O-P-T-R-E-E. And I cannot find that thing locally anywhere. I can find one. There's one for sale up in Delaware, Ohio, but Yeah, I don't want to vibe up there. So. Why is it so uncommon for this is a native plant?
Is this hop tree? Do you happen to know the native name or the Latin name of this? Sorry.
Yeah, see, I wasn't prepared for that question.
Is this Petalia trifoliata? Is that the...
Yes. Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
Also called a wafer ash.
Yeah, I've never seen those in commerce regularly. There is a place in Indiana, I'm trying to think of the name, that grows tons of... If you email the show, I'll get back to you on what the name of that nursery is, and it would be your best shot for an oddball like that. But most regular nurseries aren't growing that.
Hmm. This is fascinating. It's in the citrus family.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they could. You can also use it to make beer.
Oh, but, Woody Warehouse is what the place is called over in Indiana.
Okay. Woody Warehouse?
Mm-hmm. And if they don't have it, I don't know who would grow it.
Well, I know one source up in Delaware, Ohio, so that's probably closer. But okay, so I'm glad to get that information out there.
Thanks so much, Joe. Best of luck with your hop tree. We got an email from Steve who says, listeners should be careful when moving plants and especially soil. Gardeners do not want to unknowingly introduce pathogens, fungus, and other pests to a new, not nearby habitat. Shaking your head in agreement with that, Teresa.
Yeah, no, that's entirely true. That's a really good point. I have heard stories where people have moved plants, and sometimes it's been commercially moved, and they've brought along things such as invasive ants and things like that. And you don't want to transmit those types of things.
Yeah. We have a few other emails. We'll see if we can get through them. Jim emailed to ask, on one of my maple trees, the bark is falling off near the bottom of the tree, but the rest of the tree still looks healthy. Is it dying? The tree is about 25 years old. What do you think, John?
It sounds like an autumn blaze maple to me, and it may not be, but this is a tree that grows really rapidly and fast and ends up either with girdling roots wrapping around the trunk or from frost cracks, but it usually ends up with a lot of exposed trunk wounds at the base of it as it gets a little bit older about that age. And if it's not that, it's probably something that was a mechanical injury of some sort, could have been years ago, that it's just now showing as well. I don't know without seeing the tree, but doesn't mean the tree's dying. But if, you know, there may be structural issues or other things that come into play for safety where you may want to have somebody take a look at that.
We got an email from Peter who asks, I have several buckeye trees that tend to lose their leaves much earlier than any others. They turn brown in August and fall off. The rest of the growing season, they look fabulous. They do grow slowly, however. Why do they lose their leaves like that?
There's a fungus called Gignardia leaf blotch, which has always been on buckeyes as long as I've been in horticulture. And it is a native fungus on a native tree. And it's typically pretty sustainable, even though the trees look really bad through the summer. And Ohio buckeyes tend to get it worse than the yellow buckeye or the red buckeye or the bottle brush Ohio's. And the horse chestnuts also tend to get it pretty bad. And you'll know which buckeye's which because an Ohio buckeye has a spiky husk, horse chestnut has a spiky husk, yellow buckeye has a smooth husk. And there's other factors. I'm not going to go into all of them, but I bet he has an Ohio buckeye based on how bad the leaf blotch is.
Is there anything he should do about that fungus?
I don't think so. You can certainly treat and minimize that, but I really think the best thing to do is just deal with it.
Okay. We got an email from Carol who asks, I recently planted 4 small eastern redbud trees in my backyard. One survived and is doing well, but the other 3 died quickly. Leaves shriveled and turned brown, then the trees died. I'd like to try again with redbud trees. What should I do to help ensure the new trees survive the planting? They have partial shade and the typical heavy clay soil for this area. You have thoughts on that, Teresa?
Yeah, I'm thinking about this because I love redbuds. They're one of my favorite trees. So the mention of the heavy clay in the soil makes me pause a little bit. So number one, you need to make sure that the soil is prepared. So you might have to dig a bigger hole, make sure that you have the appropriate, you know, amendments in there for success of the tree. Of course, you need to water it. I'm assuming here that the listener did water it. Or I've killed a tree by actually putting it in the wrong spot where the water collected and it had too much water.
Mm, you so drowned that, it.
I drowned it, yeah. Sadly. Joe? John. I'm thinking Joe.
One of the most critical things when you're planting a tree is getting the root flare at the right height. And more often than not, people are burying the root flare. And that can be because the nursery sold it to you where the root flare is already below the soil, or in a bald and burlap situation, they pile up the dirt around it through the way they take care of the weeds over the course of the life of the tree. And really what you need to do is pull all of the soil back from the top until you see the tree get wider as it goes into the ground. And that should be planted at ground level. In a wet, poorly drained scenario, I'd recommend raising that up an inch or two and feathering out the topsoil in a really nice smooth grade around that. And that's something that's often missed that can make a huge difference.
Okay. We have more emails. Barb says, my serviceberry, this is the second year, does not seem like it's growing much. It's in full sun and I've used pellet fertilizer on it in the spring. I also have made sure it's watered well as it's a new tree. Any tips for other or better fertilizer? Any thoughts?
I have a lot of trouble growing serviceberries reliably. They're getting a lot of foliar fungus. They get fire blight. They really like a moist, acidic, well-drained soil, and we're planting them in clay here. It's not that they never work, and when you see them work, they're absolutely beautiful. But I would really focus on soil amendment, maybe getting something like pine fines or something like that that's got some good acidity, mulching with that year after year. I don't know that a specific fertilizer, maybe like a holly tone would be something that I would apply to help it out a little bit, but it may never do great even with the best of care.
Zach writes, two pawpaw trees in my backyard. He has heard that they need to be different varieties from each other in order for them to bear fruit. Is that true, Teresa?
Yeah, that's what I've heard as well. Yep. So pawpaws do need to have two different varieties that are genetically different, so two different cultivars. But I actually want to throw this over to Dominique as well.
Yeah. Dominique, no,
that's definitely, yes, that's definitely the case. Because, the first set of pawpaws that we planted, they were donated to us and they were all the same variety. And, after a few years, we realized that nothing was happening. And, we just happened to have a pruning event. And one of the professionals at pruning or tree care told us, these are the same species. And that's the problem you're having. That was our first hard lesson in planting pawpaw trees, which is why since then we've kind of shied away from planting them, regardless of how much we love the fruit. But that is very true.
They just don't want to date their sisters. I can understand that. And Bonnie emails with a suggestion for a previous caller. My lavender is hardy and comes back every spring. No need to dig it up and bring it in over the winter. I've been talking
That's true. That yep. is what I was going to say, but we'd already went to the next question, so just leave it where it's at, and it'll come back next season.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Madison Tree Care and Landscaping CEO John Butcher, University of Cincinnati professor Teresa Cully, and Brick Gardens owner Dominique Peebles. Thank you all so much for being here. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu, and Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.